Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, November 11, 2022, Veterans Day. Vice President Kamala Harris placing a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and delivering remarks at Arlington National Cemetery, saying to the nation's veterans, every day through your life's work and your example, you make America stronger. On Veterans Day, we come together to express our profound gratitude for all you have done and you continue to do. We'll also hear from Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough at Arlington Cemetery and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Program. Vice President Harris at Arlington Cemetery because President Joe Biden is overseas at the United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt. He told the audience there that addressing climate change is more urgent than ever, and we can no longer plead ignorance to the consequences of our actions or continue to repeat our mistakes. He announced tighter restrictions on emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas. U.S. House Republican delegation also traveling to Egypt for the climate summit. We'll hear from a leader, Garrett Graves of Louisiana, about how Republicans view this issue, especially since they may soon have a majority in the House. On the midterm election results, we'll hear from Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming and Republican Senator Mike Lee of Utah. And an update from NASA on any damage to the Artemis 1 moon rocket, which was on the launch pad in Florida when Hurricane Nicole roared through. First Lady Jill Biden hosted a Veterans Day breakfast at the White House this morning, announcing new support for children who live with wounded service members and veterans, the program called Hidden Helpers Coalition. Then the First Lady, joined by Vice President Kamala Harris, the Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, and cabinet officials, went to Arlington National Cemetery. For a wreath laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, there are about 19 million veterans in the United States, about 7% of the population. 13 million of them are over age 50. There are also 1.3 million active duty service members in the United States Armed Forces, the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force, and another 825,000 National Guard and Reserve service members who can be called on in an emergency. After the wreath laying over in the nearby amphitheater, a ceremony to honor veterans. Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough speaking about veterans throughout U.S. history who served, even after they have left the U.S. military.
When our country needed someone to finally break the color barrier in Major League Baseball, it was Lieutenant Jack Robinson who did it. With his talent only exceeded by his courage, discipline, and determination. When our country needed to win the space race, it was Lieutenant J.G. Neil Armstrong who planted his foot on the moon in that giant leap for this nation and for all mankind. When our country needed to heal after Vietnam, it was Corporal Jan Scruggs who created the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall and helped open the nation's hearts to the heroic service of Jack and his fellow Vietnam vets. When our country needed, for the first time, to embrace the needs and challenges of disabled American kids, it was World War II veteran Dr. Samuel Kirk, the father of special education, who led that historic change. And when we needed to be educated on the effects of toxic exposure on the battlefield, Specialist 4, Kelly Kennedy, told human stories of suffering service members, veterans, and families, including the 11 families I heard about over breakfast this morning, so we would not forget. Those stories, those vets, Robinson, Armstrong, Scruggs, Kirk, Kennedy, those are the vets you already know. But there are many more vets just like them, whose names we may not know, but whose impact resonates in every community across the country. You see, when the country needs something difficult done, when we need to do the hard thing, the right thing, so often it's veterans who answer the call. Whether defending our nation overseas or strengthening the fabric of our communities here at home, their honorable service, your honorable service in uniform, sets the example for the rest of the country. They're the caretakers of our national ethos. That deep and abiding sense of purpose they learned in serving. Their camaraderie, their determination, their sense of teamwork that made them stronger together in combat and now in their communities. That's exactly what we need today. Camaraderie, truth, togetherness, true service, true patriotism, because we are indeed all stronger when we're together, when we're one.
Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough at Arlington National Cemetery. On this Veterans Day, November 11th, because it was the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918 that World War I came to an end after 4 years of war, and in 1919, President Woodrow Wilson proclaimed November 11th as the first commemoration of Armistice Day to celebrate and observe the end of the hostilities with parades and public meetings, and it called a brief suspension of public business. In 1938, Congress established Armistice Day as a legal holiday, and in 1954, following other wars, including World War II and the Korean War, it was converted to Veterans Day, honoring all veterans. Also speaking at the Arlington National Cemetery ceremony today, Vice President Kamala Harris.
So we gather to pay homage to all those who have served our nation in uniform, at home and overseas, in times of war and in times of peace. Generations of veterans defended our country and our most sacred values. From the fields of Yorktown to the trenches of the Marne, from the beaches of Normandy to the banks of the Chosin Reservoir and the streets of Saigon, from Baghdad to Fallujah to Kandahar, you stood as one to protect our democracy and our freedom. And even when you returned home and took off your uniform, you continued to serve and to lead in communities across our country. Veterans, after all, are nurses and firefighters, little league coaches and small business owners, faith leaders and elected officials, mentors and teachers. Every day, through your life's work and your example, you make America stronger. And on Veterans Day, we come together as a nation then to express our profound gratitude for all you have done and continue to do. Here, on hallowed ground, we also remember those who gave their lives for our nation. We remember our service members who have not yet returned, and their families, and we reaffirm our commitment to bring home all those missing in action. Veterans represent the best of America. Unwavering courage, unmatched talent, and unshakable devotion. You come from every corner of our country, and out of many, you become one, the greatest fighting force in the world.
Vice President Kamala Harris at Arlington National Cemetery. Both she and VA Secretary Dennis McDonough also highlighting the work of the Biden administration. The work, they say, is improving the lives of veterans and their families. including the recently signed law called the PACT Act that expands VA health care and benefits for veterans exposed to burn pits, Agent Orange, and other toxic substances. There are nearly 400,000 people buried at Arlington National Cemetery, which sits on over 600 acres of land in Arlington, Virginia. C-SPAN interviewed a couple of years ago the executive director of the Army National Military Cemeteries, Karen Durham Aguilera, about how it operates.
What's remarkable in a major metropolitan area near an airport, near the Pentagon, is just how peaceful it is.
Well, we've tried to make it feel that way as much as we can. For example, we want all of our families that are there to see their loved one laid to rest to feel as if they're the only ones there in the cemetery. So we manage using the entire cemetery. There will be five or six burial services going on at the same time, starting at 9 in the morning till about 4 p.m. in the afternoon. But we try to arrange things so that a family at a particular time thinks they're the only people going on in the cemetery. That is no casual matter because we get average 11,000 people a day that are there to visit, pay their respects to this hallowed ground and the national icon. We have honor flights and tour buses and student groups and wreath laying ceremonies. And then we also have a lot of construction as we repair some of our infrastructure and then also make improvements. I just remain amazed at the way our team can do this every day in almost a seamless manner. We truly strive to be perfect.
Explain that process. Just how does it work?
Well, first, we have literally hundreds of families that call us to request a burial service. So we always have more of a demand than we can ever do. We average nearly 30 burials a day, every single day. And then on Saturdays, we will have up to 10 services where there's no military honors. But sometimes for the families, Saturday is the only thing that works for them, and that's what they request. So a family will call into our call center. They will request a burial service for their veteran or for that eligible family member. There's a certain amount of documentation they have to provide to us. We have to determine that the person is indeed eligible for burial at Arlington National Cemetery. And then depending on the level of honors and escorts that are rendered and that branch of the armed service that provides the honor guard, families can wait any time from a few weeks for a dependent to 6 to 9 months to be able to schedule, you know, a service for their family member.
Karen Durham Aguilera, Executive Director of Army National Military Cemeteries, part of the November 2018 episode of C-SPAN's The Weekly podcast. Find C-SPAN's The Weekly wherever you get your podcasts. And this week's episode of The Weekly podcast is on the 40th anniversary of the dedication of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. C-SPAN covered it in 1982, and we'll look back at the 40-year history of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial by remembering through C-SPAN coverage presidents who have visited and what they said. Again, find C-SPAN's The Weekly wherever you get your podcasts. There was a Veterans Day ceremony today at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Remarks from Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
For four decades, this memorial has brought Americans together no matter what they thought about the war in Vietnam. And in that time, another generation of veterans has come home. And I'd like to recognize all of those who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Each of you is also a part of that story of service. And in 2008, one of my fellow Iraq vets came to this sacred place, and he left a pair of his combat boots at this wall, size 12. And along with the boots, he left a note on Marine Corps stationery. And he wrote, quote, "Brothers, these are my lucky boots. They got me through two wars on the ground in Iraq. I figured you would appreciate them more than a garbage man." And his note continued, "The truth of the matter is that we owe you an awful lot. If your generation of Marines had not come home to jeers and insults and protests, my generation would not have come home to thanks in handshakes and hugs. And he ended by saying, "Rest easy, gents." And he signed it as Frank, First Lieutenant, United States Marine Corps. And as Frank said, American troops should always come home to thanks and handshakes and hugs. And as we know, after the Vietnam War, that wasn't always the case. Yet so many veterans worked to build bridges, to heal the nation's wounds, and to ensure that their successors would be treated with dignity and respect. Let me also recognize Jan Scruggs and Bob Dubik for their tireless work to build this memorial and its 40-year legacy, a legacy of healing, a legacy of remembrance, and a legacy of understanding. To all of our veterans, by lending your talents to the United States military, you made us stronger and smarter. By serving with courage and compassion, you set an example for the next generation. And by giving so much, you reminded us that this democracy is worth defending.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial, the program on this Veterans Day. Many members of Congress tweeting this Veterans Day. Josh Harder, Democrat from California, writing, "This Veterans Day, I'm thinking of my grandfathers and all of our Valley's veterans. Their service is why we're able to enjoy the freedoms we have today. We should never take that for granted." And from Senator Bill Hagerty, Republican from Tennessee, "We owe an immeasurable debt of gratitude to generations of Americans who courageously answered the call to serve our great nation. To our veterans, thank you for your service. It will never be forgotten. God bless you and God bless America." West Virginia Governor Jim Justice, a Republican, posting this video.
"Hello, everyone. It's November the 11th. It's a really, really, really special, special day. Veterans Day. A day absolutely all of us should stop, pause. I'm your governor, Jim Justice, and I'm with you today in front of this amazing facility, the West Virginia Veterans Nursing Facility. And what they do here is off the chart. It is almost world-renowned, but it's surely nation-renowned. The work here that goes on is phenomenal. So much of our population in West Virginia have absolutely stepped up, so many. 10% or more of our population today are veterans. With all that being said, just think of how we've answered the call. And I've said it so, so many times. You know, really and truly, we owe all, not parts. We owe all of what we have in life to our veterans. We owe all that gave the ultimate sacrifice. We owe all to the active military that have given us everything that we have, all of our freedoms, the ability to enjoy this incredible day. Many, many, many of these folks stepped up and are hurting in lots of ways. And today, we're able to provide services, but we should do more. We should absolutely, with all in us, remember that November 11th is only one day, but a day that absolutely signifies just how important our veterans really are. But we should think of them every day. I challenge and I ask all of you in each and every way that absolutely today, take time. Take time, whether it be a granddad or a brother or it be a sister, whomever it may be. Take time to acknowledge someone in our military, especially our veterans today, and absolutely remember all those that gave the ultimate sacrifice for each and every one of us. It is an absolute honor for me to be able to be with you today and be with you at this incredible facility. Thank you so much for having me. God bless each and every one of you, and God bless our veterans in every way."
Video posted by Governor Jim Justice, Republican from West Virginia. A few other Veterans Day notes: the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C., dedicating today a memorial honoring Native American veterans. And up in New York City, a long tradition continues, the country's oldest and largest Veterans Day parade. The first was held in 1919. President Joe Biden not able to attend Veterans Day events in the U.S. because he began an overseas trip. The first stop, Egypt, for the United Nations Climate Summit. The president tweeting, "Our veterans are the spine of America, and as a nation, we have but one truly sacred obligation to prepare and equip the brave women and men we send into harm's way and care for them and their loved ones when they return home." And at the start of his speech at the Climate Summit, he paid tribute to veterans.
Let me start by acknowledging that this day is a day of commemoration at home in the United States. It's Veterans Day. America's veterans and their families, survivors and caregivers, are the very spine and soul of the United States. And on this special day, on every day, I honor all of those who sacrificed for our nation like my son. I want to thank one proud American veteran, a lifelong public servant, a dear friend, and literally one of the most decorated men to fight, Special Envoy for Climate, John Kerry. John. John, your commitment, your passion, your diplomatic expertise have been absolutely critical to delivering incredible progress on climate issues over the past 2 years. And I thank you, pal. I thank you for being my friend.
President Biden in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, beginning of his speech at the UN Climate Summit. From there, he went on to talk about the main subject of the gathering. USA Today reports President Joe Biden says the United States is putting our money where our mouth is on efforts to combat climate change. In the speech at the COP27 conference in Egypt, he took a victory lap on the health and climate spending legislation that he signed into law over the summer, telling the gathering we're proving a good climate policy is good economic policy. And as Russia's war on Ukraine has driven up food and energy costs around the world, intensifying the search for alternatives to its oil and gas exports, the president said the increasing volatility of energy supply makes it more urgent than ever we double down on clean energy solutions. The president also making an announcement about a new initiative dealing with methane. Here are some of his remarks.
True energy security means every nation, means that every nation is benefiting from clean, diversified energy future. No action can be taken without a nation understanding that it can use energy as a weapon and hold the global economy hostage. It must stop. And so this gathering must be the moment to recommit our future and our shared capacity to write a better story for the world. Let's build on our global climate progress, raising both our ambitions and the speed of our efforts. The science is devastatingly clear. We have to make vital progress by the end of this decade. And that's why the United States is rallying the world around climate game changers. I launched one such game changer last year in the European Commission President von der Leyen, the Global Methane Pledge. We started it with the EU and 8 other countries. In Glasgow, it grew to more than 100 countries. Now more than 130 countries have signed on to covering more than half of the global methane emissions. Methane is 80 times more potent than carbon, and it accounts for nearly half of the net warming we're experiencing now. So cutting methane by at least 30% by 2030 can be our best chance to keep within reach of 1.5 degrees Celsius target. Today, we're releasing an updated Methane Emissions Reduction Act plan, which lays out how the United States is meeting the pledge. We're investing more than $20 billion in domestic methane mitigation to do things like cap orphan wells, leaking methane, improving industrial equipment in the oil and gas sectors to reduce emissions. It also lays out strong regulatory actions, including a new proposal from our Environmental Protection Agency to strengthen standards on methane across sectors, especially from super emitters, to make sure it's not released into communities impacting on public health. All told, these steps will reduce U.S. methane emissions from covered sources by 87% below the levels of 2005 by 2030.
President Biden at the UN Climate Summit in Egypt. He also held a meeting with the Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. And from there, the president travels to Cambodia for a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and then on to Indonesia for the Group of 20, or G20, leaders conference. While in Egypt, the president also meeting with the Democratic members of the U.S. Congress who have made the trip to the climate summit, and several of those members holding their own news conference. Congressman Frank Pallone, Democrat from New Jersey, chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, saying that Democrats in the House will continue to advocate for legislation and funding to deal with climate issues, even if Republicans end up in the majority.
We still have to do more to achieve a clean, sustainable future, and we're going to continue the fight. And regardless of what happens in the consequences of the last election, I just want our global partners to know that Democrats are prepared to fight any Republican attempts to undermine these gains. Republicans have made it clear that they're going to push an extreme agenda that favors fossil fuel and corporate special interests over the interests of the American people and our allies. And Democrats are here to make it clear that we're going to aggressively oppose any proposal that would gut or weaken our hard-won climate achievements, because they were hard-won. And just solving this global problem requires global cooperation, and we're not going to falter in our commitment or in our determination to tackle the climate crisis head-on, as we've done in the last Congress.
Congressman Frank Pallone, Democrat from New Jersey, currently chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, a news conference with other House Democrats at the UN Climate Summit in Egypt. 3 days after the U.S. election, still not determined which party has a majority in the House. C-SPAN's election page at cspan.org, using Associated Press determinations for calling the House races, shows 193 Democrats, 211 Republicans, and since 218 is a majority, there are about 30 races too close to call. A delegation of House Republicans also making their way to Egypt for the UN Climate Summit, some of them holding their own news conference. Garrett Graves of Louisiana is ranking Republican on the House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis.
I think that there are three things that we all need to be thinking about as we plot a course forward in regard to energy, security, and emissions. Number one is recognizing the fact that the United States has led the world in reducing emissions, not 1 year, 2 years, but over about a 17-year history. As a matter of fact, during the previous administration, emissions went down an average of 2.5% a year, yet the abrupt changes we've seen in energy technology and energy policy over the last 18 months, we've actually seen emissions go up, not go down. We've watched energy affordability become out of reach for many Americans, which brings me to the second point. I think that there are a lot of lessons learned that we can extract from other countries, whether it be in Europe or even within our own country, within the state of California and some New England states that have tried to move in a more aggressive direction, resulting in, I think, some outcomes that are not positive. And I think the last thing is that we've got to stay clearly focused on energy affordability and not forcing our citizens into energy poverty by forcing technologies that are not exportable. There are five principles that we must adhere to as we move forward. The first of which I've highlighted three times already is the affordability of energy. It's absolutely critical. Secondly, is reliable energy technologies. The third one is clean energy technologies or clean energy solutions. The fourth one is exportable energy. And the fifth one is ensuring that we have secure supply chains. As we've moved forward in the United States and we've tried to force ourselves in a direction where you force the uptake of renewable energy technology, today, one in every four Americans, one in every four are having to choose among food, medicine, or covering energy costs, which includes gasoline and utility costs. One in every four. We've seen over the last several months where one in every five Americans have actually had to skip paying utility bills. This is what happens whenever you're not paying attention to facts, science, and data. In this case, the Department of Energy has projected that we're going to have a 50% growth in global energy demand. 50% growth in global energy demand. We need to be looking holistically in the United States and globally, looking at the resources that are available, determining how we're going to meet that growing energy demand, and recognizing that you are going to have extraordinary growth in all technology sectors, meaning wind and solar, wave and geothermal, nuclear and hydrogen, as well as oil and gas. And if we're going to be increasing global demand of oil and gas, we must ensure that the extraction, the exploration and production activities are occurring in places where we have the lowest emissions per unit of energy, which largely is in the United States and the Gulf of Mexico.
Congressman Garrett Graves, Republican from Louisiana, ranking member on the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, at a news conference with other House Republicans at the United Nations Climate Summit in Egypt. If Republicans do get a majority in the House, again, many races with no winner declared yet, as the votes continue to be counted, they've suggested eliminating that Select Committee. Wall Street today, the Dow up 32, S&P up 36, NASDAQ up 1. Biden administration has stopped accepting applications for federal student loan forgiveness after a U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas ruled unconstitutional the president's plan to cancel up to $20,000 in student debt for tens of millions of Americans. At the application page at studentaid.gov, there's this note. Courts have issued orders blocking our student debt relief program. As a result, at this time, we are not accepting applications. We are seeking to overturn those orders. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, Republican from New York, the House Republican Conference Chair, is the first member of the House or Senate Republican leadership to endorse former President Donald Trump for another run for the White House. The former president has scheduled what he calls a special announcement for next Tuesday. There is speculation he may say then he's running again for president. Congresswoman Stefanik, in a statement to Breitbart News, writes, "I am proud to endorse Donald J. Trump for president in 2024. I fully support him running again. Under his presidency, America was strong at home and abroad. Our economy was red hot. Our border was secure. Our neighborhoods were safe. Our law enforcement was respected, and our enemies feared us." She also says it's very clear Donald Trump is the leader of the Republican Party. Another Republican House member with a different perspective, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, vice chair of the January 6th committee, speaking today at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics about the midterm election results and the influence of former President Trump.
The fact that we are here on Friday and we do not know which party is going to control the House or the Senate tells you a lot about defying expectations, I think, about the extent to which it was a victory for Team Normal. I think you saw many candidates who were reflecting sort of the election denialism of President Trump rejected. Not all of them, and some races are still left to be called, but I think it was a really important and frankly hopeful outcome for democracy.
So it sounds like you're left feeling optimistic about the future of democracy. Can you make me feel better?
Well, look, I mean, I think we have a long way to go. And we certainly have a threat that we have never faced before in our country in terms of a former president who tried to overturn an election, tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power, and who still is saying things that he knows caused violence on the 6th, and for whom there's still tremendous loyalty inside the Republican Party. And I think it's a dangerous moment. We have a lot to do, but I think that the outcome this week was certainly a step in the right direction, and a very important step in the right direction.
So given the fact that election deniers did not fare very well this week, do you feel like Trump's influence over the Republican Party is waning? Or is it, if he announces, do you think he'll be a likely nominee?
Look, I think that, you know, my view obviously was after January 6th, the party should clearly have said that is a line that can't be crossed, and should clearly have said, you know, we're not going to be in a position where we're embracing insurrection or excusing it or whitewashing it. And so, you know, I thought that was obvious, and certainly most elected officials in my party did not do that. You know, people talk about Donald Trump these days as the biggest loser. And I think that's true. If you look at the, you know, the record from 2018, from 2020, from the special election in 2021, from 2022. So I think that's an important point. I also think, though, that as a party, we need to be clear that we would not be, we should not be embracing him even if he were a winner, because what he's doing and what he advocates is so dangerous.
And it does seem like a fair number of stalwart supporters of the past turned away from former President Trump with this week's election results. But there were a lot of people who started off repudiating election deniers who eventually came around to supporting them. Do you feel like there's a stiff enough spine in the party to stand up against future insurrections, or are we worried about January 6th, 2025?
No, we definitely need stiffer spines. I mean, that's for sure. And I think that, I think elected officials need to understand that words matter. And when you sort of see again and again and again people accepting things that are indefensible, you know, we watch what happens in our society, and when you accept things that you shouldn't, when you tolerate things like January 6th, then that can very easily become the new normal. Then it begins to be legal. And I think that's a big danger for us. And I think that, you know, we need to make sure that with our votes, we are encouraging those people and supporting those people who will stand up for the Constitution.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics today. She'll be leaving Congress in January. She lost over the summer in a re-election attempt in a Republican primary by over 30 percentage points to Harriet Hageman, who easily won an election this week to Congress. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, responding to a social media attack from former President Trump. The former president writing, "Youngkin," and then in parentheses, now that's an interesting take, sounds Chinese, doesn't it? "In Virginia, couldn't have won without me." Governor Youngkin telling reporters that he had not seen the post and, quote, "You all know me. I do not call people names. I work hard to bring people together. That's not the way I roll. That's not the way I behave." Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, will be returning for another six-year term. He got a challenge from an independent, Evan McMullen, who had the endorsement of the Democratic Party in that state. But Mike Lee defeated Evan McMullen 59% to 41%. Senator Lee today at a Federalist Society event in Washington asked about the overall performance of the Republicans this year.
Hi, Senator. Thank you so much for your time. So since you offered to let us ask about politics, I'm going to. We just had a midterm election, or rather...
I heard.
Or arguably are currently having one in a few states, and a red wave was very much expected, and what ended up happening can only best be described as a red trickle. So I would just ask, what
are your... Described as what?
A red trickle. So I would just ask, what do you think the party needs to do to reinvent itself in 2024, and what should be our takeaways from what just happened? Also, congratulations on your own reelection.
Thank you. Thank you. Look, as Republicans, I think we're always at our best, and especially right now, when we offer contrast, when we show how we're different than the other party. There is a tendency and a temptation in this town that some find overwhelming to make themselves more electable by moving themselves half the distance to the other party. This doesn't end well, because it turns out the other party is always moving left. And that also confuses voters. It doesn't give them a good reason to vote for us. I've always believed that we would do well, especially as Republican politicians seeking federal elected office. We will always do much better if we say, look, the federal government's too big and it's too expensive because it's doing too much stuff that it should never be doing. And here are the departments we would shut down. And here are the activities that we should allow to be pursued by state governments rather than the federal government, providing a fair amount of detail that shows how we're different than the other party. I think we win elections when we do that. We lose when we try to meet them half the distance to the goal.
Senator Mike Lee at the Federalist Society Convention in Washington, D.C. You can find his full speech and the Q&A with the audience at our website, cspan.org. Near the end of his talk, Senator Lee tells a joke about a time he met then-President Trump at the White House. The president asked him to research a question about Senate rules and procedure. Senator Lee does a fairly decent impersonation of the former president.
I was really proud of myself, and I was thinking he was just going to bear his heart out to me. Thank you so much, Mike. Instead, he goes, Mike, when the rest of us were 16, we were out chasing girls and doing crazy, crazy stuff. But then I think about you. At 16, you're not doing that, Mike. You're at home, sitting at a desk, and you're studying the Senate rules and the Constitution. Am I right? And I said, well, it's not far off. Yeah, it's kind of true. But I did like girls. In fact, that's where I met Sharon, and he goes, yeah, good point. He said, I knew it. I knew that was you. And then he turns around and he says to all the staff, and this is the critical part, and yet he has a beautiful wife. I don't understand.
Senator Lee at today's Federalist Society program. This is Washington Today. The Nixon Foundation holding today what it calls a grand strategy summit. At nixonfoundation.org, the group writes, 50 years have passed since President Nixon's historic trip to China, and the great power competition between the United States, Russia, and China has returned. This time, Moscow and Beijing are banded together in an alliance that President Nixon's strategic diplomacy prevented 50 years ago. President Joe Biden will be meeting the Chinese President Xi Jinping for the first time in person at the G20 leaders meeting in Indonesia on Monday. And at the Nixon program today, two former officials from the Trump administration asked what might come out of it. You'll hear from the Attorney General Bill Barr and Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger.
President Biden and President Xi will have their first bilateral meeting on Monday. What will each of you be looking for and listening to, and what should we keep our ears open for, which we expect? And if you had something to say to the previous comment.
Well, look,
let me start with Attorney General Barr.
Actually, I'm not sure what to expect, and I'm not really expecting anything.
And
I just wanted
to
say,
add something to Matt's comment.
I just wanted to say that it seems to me that strategic ambiguity works against the idea of deterrence. It may be a low probability, but why don't we just make it even lower by making clear what our intent is? And I think it's time for strategic clarity and impose some predictability on what would happen if they attack Taiwan. So that's my two cents on the Taiwan issue.
Okay. We'll have Matt, and then we'll have you, Jude, wrap up with sort of how this all ends and how do we prevent this cataclysmic ending. But Matt, what are you looking for out of a Biden-Xi summit?
Yeah, well, look, it's important that the President of the United States talk to Xi Jinping. This will be the first time they've met in person since President Biden was elected president. One of the conclusions we drew from our time in office was that normal diplomatic channels don't really serve to deliver messages up to the leader in that system. The system is much more rigid, and the leader is far more remote. His inner circle smaller and more insular than it was for Xi Jinping's predecessors. So it is important. My assumption is that the Biden administration has come to a similar conclusion. So it is important for them to be talking. It may be the only way to really lay down important and hard messages, including, to Bill Barr's point, a message directly from President Biden to Xi Jinping stating that the United States will come to Taiwan's defense in the event that that Xi Jinping makes a fateful Putin-esque type of decision to militarily coerce Taiwan. But I'm not expecting some kind of a breakthrough, or I think it's really more about having important hard conversations. It's an opportunity for the president to really be very clear about the kinds of costs that Beijing is going to incur if it makes some of these fateful steps that they seem to be fantasizing about.
Former Deputy National Security Advisor Matt Pottinger and former Attorney General Bill Barr both served under former President Trump at today's Nixon Foundation program titled Grand Strategy Summit. It was held in Washington, D.C. NASA with an update on the status of the Artemis 1 moon mission hardware, the rocket, the spacecraft, and the ground system equipment, which endured on the launch pad Hurricane Nicole this week. It did drop to Tropical Storm Nicole as it made its way inland in Florida. The NASA Associate Administrator Jim Free tweeting that there was very minor damage. Today in a teleconference, he said the launch is still on schedule for November 16th.
We'll start with Marcia Dunn of Associated Press.
Yes, hi, thank you. I'm just wondering what the chances, the risk of internal invisible damage might be to the rocket, and for all the plumbing with the hydrogen fuel lines, the seals, are you anticipating more potential leakage because of the shaking vibrations from the storm that the rocket had to withstand? Thanks.
Thanks, Marcia. I mean, the measurements that I talked about, those certification limits that we pick for the wind and measuring at the vertical vehicle stabilizer, and then the VSP as well, that's we kind of calculate and propagate those loads into the vehicle, so we get a way to look at how those loads propagate down to specific areas and then factor those loads in when we design it. So those factors of safety, those design margins, give us confidence that we should be okay. As far as leakage, there's purge on the vehicle all the time, so we're purging to make sure that we keep any outside atmosphere or moisture out of the vehicle, and that's intended to protect those seals as well. So from our perspective, those purges stayed up, and we feel good about the interfaces and then the design of the vehicle based on the environments we saw.
NASA Associate Administrator Jim Free on a teleconference. Artemis 1 is a test mission that will fly around the moon, the first in a series of launches that will lead to humans returning to the moon's surface for the first time in over half a century. But the launch has been delayed for a few months now due to technical issues and inclement weather. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word to get the stories Washington is talking about delivered to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.